Today is the third day of this June 2011 seven-day session. And we will continue reading from the autobiography of Chan Master Sheng Yan, Footprints in the Snow. We stopped yesterday where he became ordained by Master Dongchu. And here we will have some excerpts from the training he received after his ordination. Sheng Yan writes, "So my training began. Prior to the ceremony, Dongchu had never scolded me. But then, when he accepted me back into the monastic fold, there were many more scoldings to come. I moved into the smallest of the institute's three rooms. After several days, as I was settling in, Dongchu told me to move into the large room. 'You are a writer and like to read,' he said. 'You should have more space to read and write.' I happily moved all my possessions into the big room. The next day he told me, 'Your karmic obstruction is heavy. I'm afraid that you may not have enough virtuous karma to stay in the big room. I think it's better you move back to the small room.' I was peeved. I had just moved in. But because it was his request, I complied. A few days later, he came to me and said, 'You know what? You should move to the big room. You are right. You really need it for your books and to have enough space to write.' 'Master, don't worry,' I said. 'I can stay in the small room. There's no need to move.' 'It's my order. You should move to the big room.' He looked at me with his big square face and grave demeanor, turned on his heels, and walked away with his general's walk, leaving wind in his wake. I moved. I wasn't even there for even half a day when Dongchu appeared at my door. 'You are right,' he said. 'It's better for you to live in the small room. You don't need to move your stuff in there. Just move there to sleep.' Another couple of days passed, and he told me to move all my things to the small room. There was a lot to move, and it took a long time. A few days later, we received a guest. Late that night, Dongchu knocked on my door. 'It's better for our guest to sleep in the small room. Why don't you move to the big room for tonight?' he said. Later, he told me it would be better to keep the small room open for guests, so I should move to the big room. At this point, I lost my temper. 'Why do you keep asking me to move from one room to the other?' I whined. 'I have already moved 5 times. I'm not going to move anymore.' 'This is my order,' he bellowed, a mountain of a man who had been one of the most famous abbots on the mainland. 'I asked you to move, so you must move.' I skulked off and started the process of transferring my possessions yet again. I had no choice. This is the way it is in the master-disciple relationship. The disciple must do whatever the master asks. Dongchu kept asking me to move, and eventually I got it through my thick head that this was part of my training, so I stopped protesting and just moved. Once I just acted without hesitation, protest or resentment, Don't you let me stay put. How many of us would expose themselves to this kind of teaching, this kind of training? But the master-disciple relationship is all he has. He has no social net, not his own house, own car, own TV to spend his time. Just the need, the wish to practice and the teacher-disciple relationship. There's nowhere he can go. Of course, it's also a matter of culture. In the East, this was the way people were trained sometimes, and there are more ways that he has to go through Shangyan. One day, my master ordered me to do prostrations to the Buddha. After a couple of days of prostrations, he said to me, "This is a Buddhist institute. You are not doing anything to contribute. You should write some essays." Everything he asked me to write involved scolding people. "If I am scolding people all the time, everyone is going to hate me," I said. "You can use your pen name. Since you are a new monk, you should speak up to uphold justice." I wrote scolding essays. After he read them, Dongchu said, "You are terrible. You are scolding people too much." He didn't publish any of them. "You have committed much speech karma in scolding so many people," he said. "You should go do prostrations to repent." I went back to doing prostrations. One day he bellowed at me, "What are you doing wasting time prostrating to a wooden statue? It's useless. You should go read some real sutras." He told me to read the big sutras, not the small ones. The Avatamsaka Sutra has 80 chapters, the Nirvana Sutra 40, the Mahaprajna Paramita Sutra 600. I started in on the Mahaprajna Paramita. After a few days, Dongchu asked how many chapters I had read. I told him 30. I was a very slow reader. "You are so slow," he bellowed. "Too much karmic obstruction. There's no use reading when you read like a worm crawls. Go do prostrations to the Buddha to give rise to some wisdom." So I did prostrations. After a few days, Dongchu berated me again. "Shangyan, look at yourself. What are you doing is of absolutely no use. You should do something concrete to make yourself useful." "What should I do?" I asked. He pointed to a pile of bricks. The individual bricks had been mortared together. Each piece of brick that made up that wall, Dongchu says, was a contribution from our followers. "It is such a waste for them to sit there idle. You should go and rearrange the bricks." And then for several pages, he's reporting how he worked with these bricks. I looked at the pile of broken bricks and thought, this is so awful, so pointless, so tedious. There was no way I could piece the bricks back together. I don't know how to go about this, I protested. It's impossible to put the pieces back together. You are useless, responded Dongzhu in a harsh tone. Looking at me with his stern, unyielding face, arms crossed over his big body. Why is it impossible to put the bricks back together so that we can make good use of them? From then on, Dongzhu didn't ask me to do prostrations or write essays or read sutras. I had to put the brick pieces back together. I felt it was such a waste of time. I mustered my courage. Is it really worth the time to put these bricks back together? I finally asked Dongzhu. What is your time worth? He replied. You live here for free and eat for free. What is the problem? Go and reassemble the bricks. Don't be wasteful. Those were the orders of my master, so I continued on with the bricks. At first, I was at a total loss, but then, miraculously, it became easier. I could see how the bricks fit together. I could piece together 3 bricks a day. It took me 15 days to do them all. I had no idea what he was going to do with the bricks when I was finished. I just did it. When I was done, Master told me, "Now stack up the bricks." "How?" I asked. "These bricks have been broken. They won't hold up." But he insisted. I was puzzled, and I went outside to take a break. As I walked around, an idea came to me. I saw the large leaves of the wild taro. I put several pieces of bricks on a leaf, then put another taro leaf with bricks on top of it. Now I could pile the bricks on top of each other without having them crumble. It took me several months to get it done, and each day I wanted to run away. So tedious and ridiculous was the work. When the bricks were finished, Dongzhu treated me to one of his rare moments of mirth. "You have been tricked," he laughed. "Ha!" His big belly shook. He was really enjoying himself. "These bricks are useless," he said. "You must be mad at me over this." "I was a bit mad," I admitted, sulking. "But you are not so bad," he said. "You are actually quite patient." Perhaps because I had demonstrated patience, Dongzhu let me live in peace for a few months. But then, one day, he pointed at a spot in the kitchen where the ceramic tiles had fallen off. "Shengyan, you have to fix this," he commanded. "Go to the construction material company and buy exactly the same tiles and replace the ones that are missing." Well and good. This didn't seem to be such a difficult task. I was always being sent on these types of minor errands. Little did I know the ordeal in store for me. And then it's a long story where he has to find these 3 kitchen tiles, and he cannot. He goes to different shops all over Taiwan, and they send him away because they say, "No, we have similar bricks, but not similar tiles, but not the exact ones." Then he's sent to a place, to a kiln, where they have all kinds of rows of tiles, but he couldn't find an exact match. And he asks, everywhere for these tiles, and they just sent him away because of three pieces of tiles. They won't burn them, they don't have them. Then he again musters up his courage and says, "It's just a few pieces of tile." I groaned, too tired and frustrated to keep my feelings bottled up any longer. I felt like a 30-year-old child. I was an officer in the army, for goodness sake, a published author, and here I was scouring Taiwan for tiles. "Why can't we just buy three pieces that are close in color? It's just kitchen tile." I glared at him and said nothing. Dongchu ordered me to go out to look for the tiles. I wandered around, not going anywhere in particular, brooding on Dongchu's unreasonable requests. I made up my mind to leave the monastery. When I returned, I went straight to my room. I was frustrated to the point of being numb. Dongchu popped his head in. "Where have you been all day?" he asked. I refused to talk to him. He left my room and came back with three tiles. "We are so lucky," he exclaimed. "I found three tiles left over from the last kitchen renovation. They were stuck in a crack in the wall." He looked at me and laughed. It was a ghastly sound. "You are tricked again," he said. "You are a monk. How can you get mad? I got you again. That's so funny." And he left the room. I should have been furious, but oddly, my frustration dissolved. I sat in my room after he had left, empty and at peace. I realized that I had no desire to leave Dongchu. I realized that the search for the tiles had been part of my training. I think there's a lot of wisdom in this, even though this is Eastern culture. We can learn from this. We can learn from the frustration, from Sheng Yan's response to being scolded. How is it when we are when something is pointed out to us, hold our hands in a different way during Kinhin, maybe do a job in a different way, play the instruments louder or softer, different spaces between the beats, are we really open like an empty vessel and take on the, whatever it is, advice, maybe criticism? Or do we come up with our own ideas how we think things should be done. Defensive, knowing things better, or objecting. There's a way of just going with the flow, being accepting what is being said to you, instead of saying yes but. And we want to be applauded rather than being criticized. And then we learn to not be flattered, elated when we receive praise, and not being desperate or put down when criticized. A Zen person knows her or his worth, his value. And yet, here we see how like a pebble in a brook, like a pebble in a mountain brook, the ego is softened, is worn down, rubbing, and the stones rub against each other. Okay, that's enough from Shengyan's autobiography. He goes on then with biographical material, how he then went to Japan and trained in different traditions, and especially one is interesting that he writes about where he worked in Sesshin with a Dharma heir of Harada Roshi, and then he finds out that Roshi Kaplow is his Dharma brother, because he trained in the same line. And then he opens his monastery in Taiwan and a training place in upstate New York, and writes about this, and it's for Teisho it's not exactly interesting. So now let's go on to Shengyan's teaching. And I have here an account of a retreat that he led in 1989 in Wales, in England, or Great Britain. And the title of the book is called Catching a Feather on a Fan. A Zen Retreat with Master Shengyan. And there's a dedication on the first page which says, "To all practitioners seeking to develop a sure-footed Zen in the West." That's what we're doing. Developing a sure-footed Zen in the West. So it's a Sesshin. It's the accounts of a Sesshin he held a little over 20 years ago. It was the first Sesshin that he held at that place, so most people were new And his advice at the beginning of Sesshin is very much what we have here. No talking. No thinking, he says also. For some tasks, you need to consider what you are doing or to plan the sequence of your actions. But for many jobs, thinking is not essential. Just let the hands do it. Let the mind be on whatever you are doing. Just do it. Don't evaluate it or compare yourself with others. Put your mind on the job, on the eating, on the toilet. No looking at others. We say, don't look up, don't look around. He says, it is of no value to you to see how others are doing or coping with problems. On a retreat, to consider how others are is to fill the mind with inessential concerns. It is not your business. I remember in the early Sesshins in Sweden and Germany, people came out of Sesshin and they told each other the things they had watched others had done and were laughing. And this is not the way of serious practice. If you have done this a few times, you see how futile it is and that it's just a waste of time. This is what is so great about this arrangement here that we have with the monitors taking care of things. If a problem happens, the monitors can take care of it. You don't need to worry. You have actually, you have a very protected environment. No phone calls, no mail. It's sheltered, protected, so you can give all your attention to your practice. Nothing else that needs to be done. At this point of Sesshin, you don't even have to worry about making mistakes. You just follow along the flow. If you do a mistake, okay, notice it and don't do it again. It's no use in pondering over it, evaluating yourself, thinking, oh, why does this happen to me? Me again, it's always me. How can I get anywhere when I'm still so much concerned with myself? Just leave it at that and return to the practice. The good thing about Buddhism is you always have another chance. There's always the next round, the next breath, at least as long as we are alive. You always get a new chance, a chance to leave behind the past, to let go of the thoughts that bother us and pick up this practice. No looking about, Shengyan says. No listening to pleasing sounds. Keep the senses quiet. Don't look around at the scenery. Likewise with sounds, bird songs. Treat them all the same. Pay no attention. Of course, you will see and hear, but do not intentionally look about or listen evaluatively. The aim is to stop the sources of discrimination. No analysis of whatever is said in the talks or instructions. If I say something that is helpful to you, fine. If not, forget it. This is very good advice. If you hear something in the Taisho or the talks, if it makes sense, if it gets under your skin, fine. It's like coming in through one ear and maybe dropping like a seed and sprouting. But if not, let it go out through the other ear. No analysis. Don't pay any attention to whoever is sitting next to you, whether you are complaining, whether they are complaining or happy. In this world, all you know is yourself, nobody else. And, in fact, you don't know yourself either. The best thing on retreat is to keep the mind a blank, filled only with practice. The whole day is practice, whether we are sitting, doing exercises, walking, prostrations, or cooking, listening to a talk, the whole focus is on the practice. When you try to calm the mind, there are two important principles. We need to be clear about these. The first is to cease worrying, and the second is not to be concerned with knowledge. For your practice to be effective, you don't have to worry, and you don't need to understand intellectually. We would like to be able to concentrate fully on our method, be it counting the breath, silent awareness, or working with a koan. Yet the more we try, the less concentration we achieve. Our minds simply do not obey our intentions. We try to stay with the method, but before we know where we are, the mind has drifted away onto something else. Our attitude is wrong somewhere. We feel frustrated and lost. we should stop thinking about the ongoing problems of our lives and relationships. Of course, these things are important, and after the retreat, we shall take up such issues again. But here and now, in the retreat, we should let them go. Keep your distance from the past and the future. What is it that makes this so difficult? Mostly the thoughts that arise are concerned with the past, or perhaps with the future that will arise as a result of the past. This involves discrimination, judgment, comparison, and memory. It is vital to practice putting all this down. Just put it down. Leave aside all past, all knowledge. With practice, you can let it go. Please do not misunderstand me. It is not that knowledge and experience are to be avoided or condemned. Rather, knowledge and experience are to be valued, but we need to gain control of their use. If we leave them to ramble haphazardly through our heads, sowing worries and agitation, then they become a burden to us, a vexation and an obstacle. Some people spend all night worrying. Others put away their thoughts and sleep soundly. We need to cultivate the art of putting aside our memories, our concerns, and our intellectual knowledge. This causes anxiety or fear. What will happen to me when I let go of these thoughts, memories, because we identify so much with that, what we are thinking. We even believe that what we are thinking is true. We believe our thoughts. That's a big problem. Thoughts are just thoughts. You could see them as clouds coming, passing. Or bubbles in when we read comics, these bubbles that contain the thoughts. They come bubbling up and then they leave and they return and others come. In the beginning of practice, you feel that these thoughts are clinging to us. They are sticky, glued to our mental processes. And we want to take away the glue and be free from them. But then we might realize that it's not the thoughts that are sticking to us, but rather we are clinging to the thoughts. Every moment we have a choice. Every moment we can decide, do we follow our thoughts or do we turn to our practice? At least during the moments when we come up, when we, it's like we are sunk, diving deep into thought, and we come up to get some air, and we realize, what am I doing here, sitting in Sesshin? At that moment, when we get back to the present, we can decide, diving down into the thoughts again, or picking up the practice. It's all in our own hands. We ourselves are responsible for what we do with these moments. Wallowing in thinking, remembering, planning, maneuvering, or just letting it go and turn to the practice. It's so simple. It's so unbelievable simple. And yet, it seems like the hardest thing in the world. Because the thoughts, they overpower us. They come from the back. They come from below, from everywhere, if we let them. And it's not that we have to fight the thoughts. The brain produces these thought bubbles just like the stomach produces gastric juices. It's a natural process. But it's a matter of whether we have these thoughts control us, take over, take the driver's seat. When you pick up your practice, you are reclaiming the driver's seat again. You are sitting yourself in your seat, in the present. Time is up. We stop now and recite the four vows.